Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Siva Vaidyanathan.
Hey everyone, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, April 23rd. You'll notice I'm joined once again by Siva Vaidyanathan, who's guest hosting again this week. Siva is the director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. He's also the author of a book called Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, and the book The Googleization of Everything. Siva, thanks for coming on again.
Oh, April, thanks again for having me back. I had such a great time talking with you last week and being part of the show last week, and then even better, the reaction and response I got from the listening audience was really outstanding.
And I got some emails, too, which I should forward you. People really did enjoy your interview with Andy Greenberg. If you didn't catch that last week, please do and subscribe. On today's show, we'll talk about how the Sri Lankan government shut down Facebook and WhatsApp after the attacks on Easter Sunday that killed nearly 300 people.
After that, we're going in on a key part of the Mueller report, the Russian cyber attack on the Democratic National Committee and the release of documents through WikiLeaks, as well as an odd persona invented by Russian intelligence. Joining us to discuss this is Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri, a writer for Motherboard who has corresponded directly with some of the Kremlin-linked hackers.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we saw on the web this week. But this week, we have a very special guest joining us for the end of the show. That's all coming up on If Then. Okay, Siva, so let's actually hop into the news because, sadly, there is another tragedy this weekend in Sri Lanka. 300 people, or almost 300 people, died after a series of bombings on Easter Sunday at churches and in cities across the country. And in response to that, the government decided to shut down access to Facebook. And that has had a mixed response throughout the world. I mean, my initial, and I think a lot of people's initial response was, well, maybe this would help stop the spread of disinformation after a tragedy. But that quickly became a much more complicated picture. Can you help us kind of unpack what's going on there?
Sure. Well, you know, when you look at one of these events, one of these terrible events where social media services are possibly implicated, it's always important to remember the specificity, the specific history and politics of the place we are talking about. So Sri Lanka is still emerging. It's about 10 years after the end of a 20-year civil war, a civil war that was largely fought between the Buddhist majority, about 70% of the country is Sinhalese in ethnicity and language, and they're almost all Buddhist, and the Tamil minority. And the Tamils are about 16% of the population, and they're overwhelmingly Hindu, but there are a large number of Christians, Tamils as well, and most of those Christians are Catholic. So this attack on Easter Sunday was directly at the Catholic minority. There were also attacks on hotels, by the way, in some of the larger cities that seemed to be aimed at foreigners, at foreign tourists, something we've seen time and time again with these sorts of terrorist attacks.
And, you know, this is not the first time that the government in Sri Lanka has decided to close down access to social media after a tragedy. This happened in March of last year, right? After two people were killed and multiple others injured in an anti-Muslim series of riots in a tourist district in Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka, like several places in the world, much like it, has experienced a lot of ethnic and religious violence very recently, clearly fueled by the spread of rumor, disinformation, misinformation, hate speech on WhatsApp and Facebook. I mean, that definitely happened in 2018. Things are still tense. The targets of that violence were members of the Muslim minority in Sri Lanka. And so the government was very on edge about that. I mean, the government definitely does not want ethnic and racial strife breaking out before an upcoming election later this year.
Right. And so it seems that it's a bit of a circular rationale here, right, where social media has caused a lot of disagreement and kind of hate to perpetuate. And so one way to stop the spread of that is to just shut it down. But then that also limits access to other information, too, right, because these platforms have become essential conduits for people. I mean, essentially, Facebook, because of the internet.org efforts of Facebook, where it offers free access to just certain parts of the internet, primarily Facebook and a few other websites it partners with, has kind of become the internet for people in this part of the world.
That's right. So Sri Lanka is one of those places in the world where Facebook and WhatsApp are the dominant communication systems for most people. They're the dominant sources of information for most people. They are how people connect with their family and friends, not only in Sri Lanka, but beyond Sri Lanka. So they've grown into such deeply important parts of people's lives that any effort to shut them down creates chaos and havoc and anxiety among people who have either nothing to do with the event or, I think perhaps more importantly, those who actually have been touched by the event, right? So if you were close to one of the bombings or you attended church at one of the bombings and you wanted to tell your friends and relatives that you were okay, you had no way to do that in the wake of these bombings as these services were turned off. You know, and it's one of those things where it's also important to remember that the Easter Sunday attacks were not fomented by social media.
Right.
These were more classic terrorist attacks organized by a complicated and well-trained network of terrorists. And they weren't examples of mass mob violence, the kind of violence we have seen in Sri Lanka even recently.
Right. And I mean, really what we're talking about when the government shuts down forms of communication, that really could be classified as a form of censorship and really has a kind of an authoritarian tinge to it. And it's something that we really need to keep mind of when we talk about, you know, wanting the government to rein in these companies or at least force them to be more accountable to their user base. They have become essential conduits of communication and information. And asking the government to just shut them down or, like, you know, I remember when the UN released a report on the violence in Myanmar against Rohingya communities, another journalist asked, you know, why not just shut Facebook down there? And then a number of people who I spoke to who work with in the country said that that would actually be really stifling to communication there and could possibly, you know, make things worse and be very destabilizing for people and in a way that they wouldn't be able to necessarily just like bounce back and recover from and live a life without Facebook so easily.
You know, in both Myanmar and in Sri Lanka, these are not free societies in the first place. These are not societies with a free press. These are societies where information is already suppressed, where dissidents are already suppressed and tortured and imprisoned. And the shutdown of WhatsApp and Facebook is sort of par for the course. So first of all, we shouldn't be surprised that that happened. But secondly, we shouldn't celebrate it blankly, right? Because what might work in India or what might work in the Philippines or what might work in Australia or New Zealand isn't necessarily going to work in Sri Lanka. We have to pay attention to the specific aspects, the history and the social tensions of a specific place. Facebook, after all, is really a local and regional phenomenon to everybody in the world. There is no such thing as a global universal experience of Facebook. Facebook is tailored very specifically to places around the world, and people adapt it to their own needs around the world. We have to keep that in mind. You can't come to any general conclusions about how to handle these sorts of phenomena around the world.
Right. Facebook is local wherever it's used. And I think that's very important to remember. It's not a community in and of itself. But let's move on to the next segment now, because we have a fantastic interview lined up with Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri, a writer for Motherboard who corresponded directly with a group of Kremlin-linked hackers who pretended to be a persona called Guccifer or Guccifer 2.0. There's a bit of a debate about how to pronounce his name. We might get into that, too. That's all coming up next.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The overly redacted Mueller report was released last week, and it offered all kinds of revealing details into Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections. This included the strange and destabilizing cyber attack on the Democratic National Committee, where troves of documents and emails were made public by a group of Kremlin-linked hackers. The leaks dominated the news cycle and provided a massive boost to Donald Trump's political campaign at key moments in the elections. As I was reading the Mueller report just earlier this week, I kept thinking, this is all so 21st century. I mean, how did all this happen? How did names like Guccifer and Assange and WikiLeaks have such an influence on the world's most powerful democracy? Our guest today has written a lot about this hack and has even corresponded, awkwardly at times, with the hackers directly. Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri is a staff writer for Motherboard with Vice. He covers hacking, information security, and our rights online. Lorenzo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, so let's start with some kind of timeline sketching here. My understanding, it was like the day after the CrowdStrike report, and this is the report that came from the investigation into the hacks into the DNC servers were released, that it was reported that, yes, there were hackers that accessed the servers, and they appeared to be from Russia. The day after that, a character that went by the name of Guccifer 2.0 comes out of the woodwork, and this was in June, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think it was 24 hours or something after the news broke that Russian hackers had hacked the DNC. And the way that Guccifer 2.0 or 2 whatever announced or claimed to be the person behind the hack was that they created a Twitter account and also a WordPress account where they released like a statement saying, this wasn't Russia, it was actually me, here's some proof.
Right. And then just some more broad stroke timing here. It was, I think, just a few days before the convention, the Democratic National Convention, that WikiLeaks released the hacked emails that were retrieved by the Russian hackers. And then days after the Access Hollywood tape, the Access Hollywood tape where Trump admitted to sexually assaulting someone, the Podesta emails came out. The timing was just kept kind of following a news cycle that could have been very damaging to Trump, but these emails kept coming out, or this character kept coming out of the woodwork at these opportune times. Let's start by kind of talking about who this character first purported to be.
Yeah, when Guccifer 2.0 came out, he claimed to be a Romanian hacker, because the whole story that he was trying to push was that, you know, the official narrative was wrong, that the hackers behind the DNC hack were not Russians, that it was him, you know, just a lone Romanian hacker. And so when this happened, we just decided, well, we thought, let's talk to him and see what he says. So we talked to him for a while and I asked him about the hack, how he did it. And some details about how he did it were already like kind of confusing because they just didn't make sense with what we knew from CrowdStrike and the DNC itself. So I had in my chat and just to give listeners the context, I'm chatting with this person on Twitter because that's the only way at that point to contact him. And I say, okay, well, who are you? Like, what can you tell me about yourself? And yeah, he says that he's a Romanian hacker, that he's not Russia. He doesn't even care about Russia. He says that he doesn't care about the elections in the United States. And so I thought, okay, let's try to see if he can actually prove to be a Romanian hacker. So I logged into Google Translate and started sending him messages in Romanian, which I don't speak, but Google Translate helped. And he answered to a few of them, but then he sort of like lost patience and was like, "You're wasting my time. I have to go," and kind of left. And then we showed the chat logs to a few Romanian speakers, and they told us that Guccifer's Romanian just did not look like the Romanian of a native speaker.
The character that you were chatting with was a bit flippant, right? If I'm quoting correctly from the story from 2016, he said, or it, the group of hackers said, "I'm a hacker, manager, philosopher, woman lover. I also like Gucci. I bring the light to people. I'm a freedom fighter, so you can choose what you like," right? Just this very kind of abrasive, almost like a caricature of an anonymous hacker.
Yeah, it was very bizarre. At the time, I didn't know if this was like, I don't know, it was just trolling me or, you know, maybe he was young. You know, at the time, it was hard to tell, but it was clear that he was in some parts he was lying, like that much was clear, right? We ran the story saying that basically this guy was lying, and it really looked like this whole persona was just an attempt by the Russians to, you know, confuse readers and listeners.
But this is a big deal, because you're potentially, whoever you think you're talking with, you're potentially talking to a group of hackers that are revealing, you know, very important kind of state political information and trying to destabilize U.S. elections. I mean, that must have just been kind of staggering to think that you're actually talking with them.
Yeah, I mean, when we finally got the confirmation, I guess, 2 years later, when the indictments came out, actually naming the GRU, which is the Russian military intelligence, behind the persona, like, I finally realized that, yes, you know, that Guccifer 2 person was someone, you know, working for Vladimir Putin. It was very bizarre to have that confirmation and to have that realization.
Why did they go with this Guccifer 2.0? Obviously a play on Guccifer, if those who are not familiar, was a hacker who was, I think, found by the FBI before, and he had retrieved a number of things, including, if I'm correct, a painting by George Bush. Can you tell us a little bit about the first Guccifer and why you think they went with the second iteration as their fake persona?
Yeah, so the first Guccifer was an actual Romanian hacker. He's now in custody in the U.S. And yes, as you said, like he hacked into some, he stole some information from George Bush, including like pictures of his paintings. He sent them to Gawker, and that's how we even found out that George Bush was painting stuff. But anyway, like he was this sort of like very strange hacker who didn't really have a motivation other than, you know, I guess he just liked hacking public figures and exposing them. Obviously, I don't know why the Russians chose this name. From what we know about, the people behind Guccifer 2, I guess what we can guess is that they wanted to pretend to be Romanian, and they wanted to pretend to be sort of like someone that was inspired by this other Guccifer. And actually, there is some history of the Russian intelligence like pretending to be others. I think in the case of Yemen Cyber Army, this was a persona that the Russian intelligence came up with to claim a hack against Saudi Arabia, I think, a few years ago. And the Yemen Cyber Army didn't exist, but like it was kind of a play on the Syrian Cyber Army. So basically what I'm trying to say is that they have tried to muddy the waters and, misattribute their own hacks by creating personas that seem to be inspired by other famous hackers.
So Lorenzo, I need some clarification on how this all came together. Could you tell us a bit how WikiLeaks and Guccifer started to collaborate? Like, how long did they have a relationship? What was their relationship? What can we make of this relationship?
Yeah, I think we still don't know the full extent of Guccifer 2's and WikiLeaks' relationship, but we learned quite a big deal from the indictment and the Mueller report. And in short, basically, at some point, Guccifer 2 reached out to WikiLeaks, offering information on Hillary Clinton and the DNC. And there was a correspondence, I think, over Twitter. They chatted over Twitter and then corresponded by email. And that's how WikiLeaks ended up publishing some of the DNC, some stolen DNC documents.
Now, WikiLeaks seemed to publish the documents at particular times too, right? Like, what do you make of the timing of the dumps or the timing of the leaks and how WikiLeaks was involved in it? Was this something that Guccifer was also involved in? Was it purely a set of WikiLeaks decisions? What can we make of that?
I don't know exactly whose decision it was, but historically, WikiLeaks has always been very good at timing their releases. I think this is something that even Assange has said publicly. Like they always try to release leaks when it's going to do the most amount of impact. But yes, in the case of the DNC and also the Podesta leaks, which did not come from Guccifer, but they also came from Russian intelligence, the timing was incredible. Like, it was basically like they did it at the best time, right? Like April, you mentioned the Access Hollywood tape. I think, like, when they started releasing the Podesta emails on that day, that was the perfect timing to distract people from the Access Hollywood tape and basically change the narrative that every journalist on earth was writing about that day.
So, Lorenzo, this brings me to a much larger question, too, because when you look at all of these break-ins of 2016, and there have been, of course, a number of very serious security breaches, both within the U.S. government and public officials, and even public officials' private email systems over the past decade, it seems like we have been very slow to learn. It seems like there was abysmal security, perhaps almost no security, for the top officials of the Democratic National Committee, and perhaps even the Republican National Committee. It seems to me like the only server that didn't get breached was the notorious server in Hillary Clinton's basement. As someone who studies cybersecurity generally, what do you make of our 20-year experience with these systems?
Well, I'm always a little hesitant to blame victims and go off and say that, everything is terrible and the security was awful everywhere. I mean, obviously, the campaigns could have done better, the Hillary campaign could have forced two-factor authentication, which they weren't at the time. That would have at least slowed down the hackers. And since then, companies like Google have made some changes that make it easier for people using Google accounts, which was the case of the Hillary campaign. They make it easier to secure these accounts. So, obviously when there is a breach, someone has screwed up, right? But also we have to think that, in this case, the adversary, to use an InfoSec lingo, the adversary in this case, the Russian government, were very dedicated. They had a lot of time, they had a lot of resources, and this was their mission, right? Like, their mission was break into as many accounts as you can, and they did. They tried to phish and trick people, thousands of people, hundreds of people. But yeah, what we learned is that during an election, people should be worried about their accounts and their servers, because the Russians are interested, but the Chinese may be interested as well. Other governments will be interested. So, yeah.
Well, Lorenzo, thank you so much for joining us today on If Then.
Thank you guys so much. This was fun.
One final quick break, and then don't close my tabs. Some of the best things we've seen on the web this week, and this week with a special guest.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's time again for Don't Close My Tabs, where we talk about some of our favorite things we saw on the web this week. But I'm shaking things up a bit because a fantastic cover story was published on Tuesday on the pages of Slate.com, or in the pages of Slate.com, rather, by Slate writer Rachel Hampton. It's entitled "The Black Feminists Who Saw the Alt-Right Threat Coming." And it is about some of the very early victims of trolling online and on Twitter specifically, and who kind of had to organize against and were attacked by mobs of racists and sexists, I think even before Gamergate, right, Rachel?
Yes, it was actually a few months before Gamergate.
It was when the trolls were kind of revving up and kind of flexing some tactics that we're now quite familiar with many years later. Can you give us kind of the year that this started and kind of the scene and the situation where you begin your reporting?
Yeah, definitely. So it's the weekend of Father's Day 2014, so June 2014, and this hashtag started trending worldwide called End Father's Day. And to a casual observer, it looks like the work of radical Black feminists, basically saying ridiculous things like End Father's Day because all these white women are taking our good Black men, or End Father's Day until men stop raping and killing us, and all these other things that are kind of walking the line of critical race theory or critical gender theory, but just don't make sense to anyone who's actually feminist. And so it's predictable catnip to a bunch of conservatives like Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson does a segment on it. Someone at the Washington Examiner does a segment on it. Ben Shapiro jumps on it. But it turns out that the accounts that were tweeting out the hashtag were all mostly fake. The hashtag was basically a campaign started by these participants on 4chan to drive a wedge between white feminists and Black feminists by painting Black feminists as like hysterical and reactionary and basically not making any sense.
Right. And so they started making fake troll accounts, specifically targeting a demographic, putting words in their mouth. And then they also eventually started attacking people directly as opposed to just pretending to be someone else, right?
Mm-hmm. And so they started attacking women directly at the point at which basically Black women online were like, this is not us. This does not sound like us. No one who is actually a Black feminist believes this. These are fake accounts. And they started this hashtag. Anasa Crockett and Shafika Hudson started this hashtag called Your Slip Is Showing, where they would tag fake accounts and say, these are not real people. And at that point, basically 4chan caught on to the fact that they were caught out. And these two women and the Black women who rallied around these two women were attacked by this community. And Twitter basically did nothing about it.
Right. Twitter did nothing about it. And this is when Twitter was saying that they're free speech absolutists, right?
Yeah, this is around that time. The Twitter PR people are kind of spotty about when they instituted their policies when I asked about it. And so at this point, it's before Gamergate, so they haven't really done a whole lot, and they're very much like, we are a platform of free speech, which obviously makes an opening for people to do terrible things under the name of free speech, as these women found out.
Right. And so Twitter didn't take them seriously. Journalists didn't take them seriously either, right? Like, Gamergate didn't become a harassment issue until kind of white women in video game journalism were kind of voicing issues, right?
Yeah, so Zoe Quinn is kind of the primary target of Gamergate. And
with all I say this with all respect to people who are victims of Gamergate, by the way.
Yeah, of course. But the thing is, the women who were targets of Gamergate very much acknowledge that Your Slip Is Showing and the Black women who noticed this beforehand are very much a part of this history. So it's not even the women who are targeted themselves. It's just media wanted a beginning point, basically, to pinpoint when online trolling became an issue and they chose Gamergate.
Right. And so, I mean, what can we learn from this now?
Yeah, I think the primary lesson from this story is listen to Black women. Yes. I think that very much the people who are most vulnerable, the people who society most wants to paint as crazy and hysterical, are more often than not telling the truth about what they're experiencing. And at some point, what Black women and marginalized people and trans people are experiencing online is going to trickle down to the rest of people who are like on Twitter. And it happened in the 2016 election, where journalists were receiving the same kind of pylons that these women had been experiencing for years. And so if people had listened in 2014, it wouldn't have been as big of an issue 2, 3, 4 years later.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe the advocacy would be more coherent and this would be something that we've already had attempted to fix as opposed to trying to fix it now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing some insight into your reporting and your fantastic story on this. I really recommend people read it because it's just essential to understand that the tactics that we're grappling with now that are calling into question how to regulate some of the most powerful companies in the world and how to make sure that people are safe and having healthy and productive conversations, these are not questions that started in 2016, and they're actually questions that started in communities that are among the most marginalized in so many aspects of life, and we really need to take their concerns seriously. And this is a fantastic reminder, in fact, an essential reminder, that when people are saying that something isn't right, even if we can't empathize with their experience, we need to listen to them because it could presage something that we're all going to deal with later on. Thank you so much, Rachel. It's great having you on with us.
Thanks for having me on, April.
All right, that's our show. You can email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, or just say hello. You can follow me and Siva on Twitter as well. I'm at April Laser, and Siva is at Siva Vaid. That's SivaVaid. Thanks again to our guests, Lorenzo Franceschi, Bicchieri. You can follow him on Twitter at LorenzoFB.
And thanks to everyone who has left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or on whatever platform you use to listen to this show. We really appreciate your time. If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, which is a partnership among Slate, Arizona State University, and New America.
If you want more of Slate's tech coverage, sign up for the Future Tense newsletter. Every week, you'll get news and commentary on how tech advances are changing the world in ways small and large. Sign up at slate.com/future news.
Our producer is Cameron Drews. Thanks also to our engineers, Topher Ruth at UC Berkeley and Robert Armengol at the studios of Virginia Quarterly Review in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Okay, we'll see y'all next week. And this is our last episode for the time being with Siva. It's been great having him for the last 2 weeks. Next week, Meredith Broussard, a professor at NYU, will be joining us to co-host. Bye, everybody.